You're listening to That Life Then, A Blue Morning, Part 2, New York City, 2001, written and read by Jack Merrill. I stood amongst the crowd on that crystal clear, blindingly blue day, watching as crowds of New Yorkers stood and cheered the impromptu arrival of first responders from cities all over the East Coast. These emergency vehicles and the men and women riding in them worked their way down the West Side Highway towards the burning pile of what remained of the World Trade Center. I tried to play it cool as tears poured out of my eyes. Danny rode up and I managed to pull myself together, and eventually we stepped back and away. We decided to ride further downtown, following along behind the lines of yelling, waving New Yorkers, everyone completely overwhelmed and grateful at the sudden appearance of this seemingly endless parade of first responders. As we got nearer to where the towers once stood, we decided to keep going and see if there was anything we could do to help out. It was already late afternoon and the fires had been burning for hours. We continued down until the West Side Highway was choked off, and then rode a couple blocks away from the river into the city, turning down Greenwich Street. As we got closer to the huge column of smoke pouring up into the bright blue sky at the end of the street, the blocks became filled with people. New Yorkers who lived downtown and others like ourselves who'd come to see if they could help in any way. And of course, all the first responders from New York City, and then all the other first responders who kept arriving in droves. There were makeshift command centers scattered all over, set up under street fair type tents, some filled with what looked like communications equipment, and others set up with tables piled with sandwiches and water. There were random people standing around on the corners handing out water and candy bars and really anything they could think of that first responders might need. As we approached Chambers Street, there was a group of maybe 200 people who were wearing identifying vests and helmets, lining up in orderly lines in front of the Borough of Manhattan Community College. Danny later told me they were members of the Community Emergency Response Team, better known as CERT. Volunteers who had trained for an event like the very one we now all found ourselves in the middle of. Word was that nobody could go any further as there were buildings right up ahead that were still on fire, and the fire department was having trouble putting them out. One really big one was still burning right in front of us. Greenwich Street dead-ended into what I now know to have been building number 7. We stood about 4 blocks away in the center of the intersection of Chambers and Greenwich, which had become so crowded our bicycles were getting in the way, so we stopped moving and stood there in the middle of the crowd, straddling our bikes, watching as this almost 50-story building burned. The side of the building facing us looked okay, but I imagined the other side must have been pulverized, as it had to have taken the brunt force of the enormous collapse right across the street. As I've said, the wind was moving steadily past us, blowing all the smoke up and out into the distance. A couple of firemen I talked to told me it didn't look like they'd be able to put out the fire, as they couldn't fight it from the front where the main part of the burn was happening, and the building at this point was unstable and likely to collapse. At that, some boss-type firemen started making all of us on Greenwich move up above Chambers Street. The push squeezed everyone even closer and tighter together, and Danny and I were now walking beside our bikes and positioned ourselves a little above the press of people, leaving us some room to ride off if the need came. We must have been there more than an hour, watching and waiting for the building to collapse. There were a few times the firemen thought it was about to come down, and they kept pushing everybody farther and farther uptown. We were now about a block above Chambers Street, and the fire was burning stronger as more smoke was pouring into the sky from the far side of the building. And then, all of a sudden, there was a murmur from the crowd, and everyone looked up. On the top of the building, there was a large rectangular-shaped box that must have contained the air conditioning or the elevator equipment or something, and looking up at it, I could see that the building was beginning to sway, just a bit, like it was becoming unstable. That's when I saw some firemen running. Huh, that's not good, I thought. I stood back looking up at the building until Danny smacked my shoulder yelling, "What are you doing? Come on, the firemen are running, it's time to go!" Everyone on the street lurched uptown, and as I looked behind me, the building started to sway again, and as it swayed in one direction, it looked like that box thing on the top didn't sway as much as the building below, and then it looked like the box thing kind of broke free and started dropping down as the roof collapsed around it. Everyone was running, and I looked over my shoulder as a huge cloud of smoke and dust more than 20 stories high pushed its way up through the canyon of buildings lining Greenwich Street headed straight for us. As we were about 5 blocks above the collapse and the wind was blowing everything back down, the cloud never made it to us. stopping about a block or two below Chambers Street before the smoldering remains joined the huge cloud behind it, belching off into the blue. We jumped back on our bikes following Greenwich Street uptown, leaving it all behind us. In the years that have followed since that afternoon, I've been told many times by many people what I saw that day. People who were thousands of miles away, yet somehow they know better than I do. They somehow know that Building 7 was purposely blown up, that there were explosions, and that nobody had expected it to come down. Huh, really? Is that what happened? Well, I'm here to say that there were no explosions, and that everyone there that day knew that building was coming down. It was no surprise. In fact, we were all waiting for it, no matter what Geraldo Rivera and others of his ilk who make their living by feeding off the tragedy of others may have once said. So to all those conspiracy-minded people out there who say they know the truth, the information that nobody's going to print, as an eyewitness, I'm saying again, Building 7 burned for hours and then fell down. Maybe that's not as shadowy or as fright-provoking as some of those other imagined scenarios, but that's what happened. The thing is, the people who traffic in these obnoxious false conspiracy theories aren't going to believe me, no matter what I say. But that's something that because of this experience, I've learned to accept. Oh, I've come across them, spewing their nonsense. And when I tell them I was there, like actually right there, they pause and then they attack me. Like I fuck things up for them by inconveniently throwing a wrench into that whack job narrative they'd bent over backwards to build into some kind of bizarre belief system. I mean, come on. There's so many things in this world that are actually real, that are actually going on and could use some attention. It just blows my mind the time and effort expended creating and sustaining these fictitious falsehoods. By now, most of these kooks have moved on to Bill Gates or the deep state or the moon landing or who knows what. There'll always be something to fill their paranoid needs. Or not. All I know is what I saw. We rode across town through Tribeca and Chinatown, then headed up through Little Italy. As we passed Old St. Patrick's Cathedral on Mulberry Street, we stopped and went inside. It's an old stone building surrounded by a large churchyard enclosed within thick, sagging red brick walls. The place was dark and vast. It had that dim, humid feeling that comes from being filled with people. And after what we'd just seen, it felt welcoming. We sat in the back for a while as people murmured, lighting candles and praying all around us. I heard someone say there was something going on up at Union Square Park, and on our way there, we stopped at another historic house of worship. I've always liked the looks of Grace Church. It's an old Gothic confection with a tall gray tower sitting right at the curve of Broadway at 10th Street. Its intricate lacy arches, its green lawn behind its short black iron gates, all of it reminds me of a New York City I never knew. An architectural artifact, a scuffed-up gem left behind. Regal, yet streaked and soiled with time. I'd never been inside, and I've never been back since. But that night, Grace Church was flickering with candles, and people were pouring in and out of its doors. Danny and I found a pew and watched as a tall fireman dressed in all his heavy-looking equipment, holding a dirty helmet by his side, kneeled on the pew in front of us, put his head down, and started sobbing. I wanted to say something, but sensed I should leave him alone. Union Square Park was teeming with people, looking like some kind of late-night street fair. At first, I couldn't figure out what was going on. Then a tear-soaked girl came up to us as we stood straddling our bikes and handed me a Xeroxed flyer. It read "Missing" in big black capital letters across the top. There was a photograph of a young white guy in a suit at the center, and there was a New Jersey 201 phone number in bold across the bottom. "That's my brother," she said. "He's been missing since this morning. I know there are people walking around Manhattan who are traumatized and experiencing amnesia, so if you see him, please call this number." She wandered off, taping up one of her flyers to a light post that was already layered deep with others. More people were walking by, handing us more Xeroxes with more photographs and more missing headlines and more phone numbers. Anyone whose attention they could get, they'd stop with a pleading look in their eyes. "This is my cousin," She was in the World Trade Center this morning, and we can't find her. Please help me find my uncle. My family's looking for Justin. Have you seen my friend Samantha? The park had become a cacophony of desperate voices, the cries of some kind of makeshift market, a spontaneous outdoor bureau of missing persons. I took a few steps back, looking across the circular cement plaza as it stepped itself down to 14th Street. It looked to me like one of those crowded city pools you see in photographs. Only this pool was filled with gasping, anguished souls, struggling as they thrashed about just above the waterline, grabbing at anything that would somehow delay the arrival of the inevitable. "We gotta get out of here," Danny said. As we rode west on 14th Street, I told him I thought we should stop by Jennifer's. "You go," Danny said. "I'll see you back at the apartment." I recounted for Jennifer all that we'd seen since leaving her that morning, staying with her an hour or so. When I got home, Danny wasn't there. I took a shower in my old claw and ball-footed bathtub, laid down and was asleep in minutes. I didn't hear Danny come in, and slept straight through till the following morning. "Get up. I have to tell you what I saw last night." Danny already had coffee for us both and was sitting on the edge of the bed. "I rode my bike all the way downtown. Like, all the way down. All the streets are cut off, but I know how to get past the checkpoints. It's unreal down there. I'll take you back with me tonight." I got up and we walked outside with our coffee and over to the corner of Greenwich Street and looked towards downtown. It was hard to believe that yesterday had actually happened. But there at the end of the street was the blank sky and a column of smoke still smoldering skyward from the ruins, as it would continue to do for the weeks that followed. "You know, most of the stores around here are closed," Danny said. "Word is the city's cut off at 14th Street and you need an ID to prove you live down here. I bet the people who own these businesses can't even get to them." We decided to ride downtown again and see if there was anything we could do to help out. All the wide one-way avenues were empty of traffic, and we rode the wrong way down the middle of Hudson, which was blocked off at Canal. We jogged over a bit and slipped down to Lower Tribeca, a few blocks to the east of where we'd been the day before when Building 7 had collapsed. We were coming down on the far side of where the towers had fallen, and as we got closer, the wind had blown more in the direction of the area we were entering. The streets and air became full of ash and airborne particles. We stopped on a corner near a girl wearing a mask who was handing out water. "I wonder if we should be wearing masks," I asked. "Well, here, you want one?" she said, reaching down into one of the boxes at her feet and handing each of us a mask. We thanked her, but as soon as we continued riding, it was clear the masks weren't going to work. They weren't airtight, and soon were covered with dust inside and out. I tossed mine and pulled my t-shirt up over my nose. The further we got, the deeper the piles of dust in the street and all along the curbs. "Look at this," I said. "It's everywhere." "Hold on a second," Danny said. He jumped off his bike and picked up a brown paper lunch bag that was lying on the street and scooped up a bunch of the gray dust, filling about 3/4 of the bag, before rolling the top closed so he could carry it with him as he rode. I tried not to think about what that dust contained. We came across another corner with another girl in a mask handing stuff out, this time Gatorade and candy bars. My mouth was dry from all the dust. "Can I have one of those?" I asked. Sure, she said, eyeing me warily. "What are you guys doing? Are you helping out somewhere?" she asked, staring at me hard. Now I felt like a jerk. Now I wasn't helping out. I was riding around drinking the Gatorade that was meant for firemen. "Come on, let's get out of here," I said to Danny as we rode off. "We'll come back tonight." We headed up a lower 7th Avenue, which for some reason above Canal is called Varick Street, and we ran into Chris Cuomo headed downtown on foot with a cameraman. I'd known Chris and his soon-to-be wife Christina for years. He must have been out reporting for ABC, as he had yet to join CNN. He immediately started giving me shit for riding up from downtown where I probably shouldn't have been. And he asked us what we'd seen. And then Danny showed him what was in the bag. I can still see Chris's face when Danny unfurled the brown paper and told him what was inside. Like I've said, Danny's an unusual guy. You can count on him to say and do things other people don't even think about. Further uptown, we ran into a couple other guys on bikes, one of whom I'd known from years before. And they told us they had tried to get all the way downtown with their video camera, but had been stopped. "I know how to get all the way down, and we're going back tonight if you want to come," Danny told them. And so the four of us made plans to meet up at 10 that night to see for ourselves what it was like down at the site where the towers had once stood. "Come on, get up," Danny said. I'd taken a quick nap after dinner and it had gone on longer than I'd planned. "Come on, hurry up, those guys are out front." I think all four of us were a little uneasy as we jumped on our bikes and headed downtown following Danny as he cut east then south, zigzagging down a very quiet island of Manhattan. Hardly anyone was out, and as we cut across Soho, the streets were mostly deserted. "They've cut off all the avenues going down, but we can get through over by the Brooklyn Bridge," Danny said, pointing the way. We silently sped past Canal Street, headed straight for City Hall and the financial district beyond. Manhattan narrows quite a bit down there, and even though we were just a couple blocks from the East River and the World Trade Center is over across from the Hudson, it's not that far from one to the other. We were just above the east side of City Hall Park when Danny pulled us over against the side of a dark building. "Okay, there's a big staging area up ahead where all the cops are meeting. We're going to walk right through it," he said. "It's on the other side of the entrance ramps to the Brooklyn Bridge. Follow me. We're going to ride up to where the cops are sitting in cars, stopping people from going any further below the bridge. But before we reach them, we're going to go left and ride up the pedestrian ramp to the walkway that leads across the bridge to Brooklyn. They won't stop us. They'll think we're headed home. Then, once we're up on the bridge, we're going to cross over and ride back down on the pedestrian ramp back to Manhattan, the one that veers to the left. They're not expecting anyone to come across the bridge, and that ramp is going to lead us right to the area where all the cops are milling around. We're going to have to split up. Get off your bike and just walk right through them. Once we get to the far side of where they are, we'll be able to take off and they won't see us. Don't look at anybody, and don't stop, no matter what. Just look like you know where you're going." We did exactly what he told us to do. I felt like I was in one of those movies where you can't wake the slumbering monsters, even though they're all looking right at you as you walk through their nest. There were probably 150 cops milling around, smoking and standing in groups, waiting to get orders about where they were supposed to go. They were all over the street and on a concrete plaza in front of Pace University. "Walk slow," one of the other guys said to me under his breath as he peeled off to my right. I glided for a bit, standing on the side of my bike, then walked out of it as we all fanned out, staggering so we wouldn't be seen as a group. There were cops all over the place, some standing around while others moved quickly shouting assignments. I kept a grim, purposeful expression on my face and walked right through the center of them. It was dark, and it worked. I could see ahead of me that one of the guys and Danny had already made it past all the cops and were back on their bikes slipping off down the slope of Nassau Street into the darkness beyond. As I neared the curb on the far side of the cops, I noticed that the gray dust had become really deep down there, and the air was now densely thick with particles, like some ghostly snow. We were now parallel and a little below the site, and for the first time I was on the wrong side of the wind. There was a very strong, odd smell. It's hard to describe that smell, like a burnt metal smell, but damp and dusty. The smell of musty metallic death. Danny later called it burnt rubber death. We'd all made it, and we're now gliding down the lightly sloping Nassau Street. As we sped by intersections, I caught glimpses up through the slices of the narrow streets towards the direction of the site, off to my right. Bright lights had been set up, and I could see the smoke still billowing into the inky black night. As we rode down through Lower Manhattan, something looked strange, and it took me a minute to realize that there were no lights on. None. No street lights, no stop lights, no lights on or in any of the buildings. Nothing. There was a glow in the sky from Brooklyn and Jersey, and an occasional tall building a block or two away that had a generator. But the buildings we were passing were pitch black, block after block after block. I'd never been in a city at night that was completely black like that. It was like we were in Batman, flying through the post-apocalyptic gray dust of an abandoned, blacked-out Gotham City. We came across some delivery trucks and cars parked along the curbs that were burnt-out shells like in pictures I'd seen from war zones. But the difference here was they were the only thing that was burned. Nothing else was even scorched. Like somehow, by being in the street, they'd been hit by a wave of pressure or something that had spontaneously made them combust. Like the towers coming down had caused them to explode. There was paper everywhere. Random sheets of singed office paper lay in the dust and all over everything. It looked like sheets of paper were the only thing that made it through intact. And then there was that dust. It was everywhere. And it was deep. Piles and piles of it. Our bicycles were kicking it up. It was in my nose and my eyes. And now with that dreadful smell permeating the air, I couldn't stop thinking about what that dust was actually made of. Two 110-story buildings had basically disappeared, crushed to the ground like they'd been put into an enormous mortar and pestle, everything reduced to powder. Desks and carpeting, marble and plumbing, artwork and elevators, glass and wiring, chairs, coffee makers, tiles, tables, lamps, phones, purses, and people. Thousands of people were in that dust. I tried not to breathe as I pedaled onward, filled with dread and adrenaline. We made a left on Wall Street just before the New York Stock Exchange, cutting down, then making a right onto Water Street, following it all the way till the buildings broke open for Battery Park and the harbor beyond. We then headed for the bottom of the same bike path that Danny and I had taken on our first date not 6 weeks before. As we made the curve around the bottom of the island, we could see huge floodlights illuminating the rising cloud in between the blocks of dark buildings. And then suddenly, the floodlights outlined a sight that stopped us all cold. "Wow, that's incredible," I thought. "Oh my God, look," one of the guys said. The floodlights cast ghostly shadows across Battery Park, and now we could see the entire park was filled with baby carriages and blankets and shoes and kids' bags and bicycles, anything and everything that had been left behind when the entire park must have watched as that first plane hit and then grabbed their kids and ran. Staring through the black night at the stark lights throwing long shadows across all this abandoned detritus shocked us all into stilled silence. We couldn't ride up through the park. The bright lights made us too exposed. So we doubled back and chose a dark side street, heading up the middle of it, straight towards the smoldering ruins. The blocks we passed were pitch black, but up ahead stood the monumental skeletal remains of the towers. Shards of the outer skin of the building, maybe 20 or 30 stories high, came into view. These twisted white remnants soaring up before us like an arched cathedral of destruction. The whole scene garishly lit up through the thick, dust-filled air with what must have been hundreds of floodlights. We were just coming up to where the buildings broke open when a large, fully outfitted tough guy who looked like some kind of soldier and was holding a weapon across his chest stepped out of the shadows right in front of us. "Hey, where do you think you're going?"
"Huh?"
we all sort of said as one. I was closest to him, and I said as casually as I could, "Oh, well, we're just headed home, up the bike path." "Don't fuck with me," he snapped. "Not tonight. I have orders to shoot on sight down here."
Okay,
I said. "Turn around, go back the way you came, and don't come this way again."
"Okay.
Yes, sir." I nodded as the four of us turned around and hightailed it out of there. And what do, right after you come across a soldier brandishing an assault rifle who tells you he could shoot you on sight if he wanted to, in the darkness below the monumental ruins of the largest terrorist act ever committed on American soil? You can't stop laughing, of course. I stifled it as best I could until we made it back to Battery Park, and then I couldn't stop. None of us could. We were all laughing and shaking our heads in disbelief at the unbelievable surrealness of it all. "Should we at least try to go up the bike path?" one of the guys asked. "No, that leads right to the site, which has got to be crawling with more guys with orders to shoot," Danny said. "I think we should be happy we didn't get fucking shot and get the fuck out of here," the other guy said. In agreement, we rode back around and out the way we came, our bikes and ourselves completely covered in that ominous gray dust. This time when we reached the plaza, we didn't bother heading up the bridge, as the cops blocking the roadway weren't stopping anyone headed uptown, and soon we were safely back home. The next day, I carried my driver's license in case I'd be stopped trying to come back, and rode up above 14th Street. I was stunned to see the city already up and running, with what looked like regular life. The streets were teeming, the sidewalks full, the avenues tangled with traffic. The Korean fruit stands were full of produce as usual, and natty New Yorkers zipped in and out of the revolving doors that fed skyscrapers. Life went on. New York City was constantly regenerating itself, and soon I too was caught back up in that regeneration. I never went back down to where the towers once stood. I can't really tell you why. I guess at first I just couldn't bring myself to go, and then I didn't want to. A couple years ago, I found myself close by. I'm not sure what brought me down, some appointment or other. I walked near that new ribbed white train station. It was still under construction, but you could go take a look inside, and I did. I stood and looked, then turned around and walked out the door I'd come in through. I might go to the museum one day. I hear it's very powerful. Everyone has a story about where they were that morning. I was lucky. My trauma is minimal. I wasn't inside the buildings. I didn't have to run for my life. I didn't lose anyone I loved, although I know people who did. I wasn't in that horrible dust long enough that it caused me any problems, although I've seen the stories of the people who were. A playwright I'd worked with was working at the Borders bookstore in building number 5 on the north corner of the site that bright blue morning. He was on his way into work when he looked up and saw the first plane go into the building. He ran for his life. My manager lost her fiancé. One of my agents lost her brother. I've known people who lost childhood friends and neighbors and family and loved ones. I lost none of these. Yes, I saw people jumping, and for that I'm scarred. Writing all this down stirs me deeply. It's a part of me and who I am. The whole event has made me acutely aware of trauma. I think about children who've grown up in war. How do they ever recover? How can they ever be able to live productive lives like the people who never had to go through such horror? Well, maybe I'm just sensitive. I don't know. Or maybe I'm not. Maybe we all have the capacity of moving forward. What other choice do we have? When I got my film developed, you know, it's funny to say that, when I got my film developed. Well, a friend suggested I bring that picture of Ginny down to a gallery in Soho where people were hanging up pictures they'd taken that morning. The exhibit became a book, Here is New York. And that's how newspapers and magazines all over the world had access to Ginny on her phone. Tokyo, Moscow, Paris, London, Sydney, Buenos Aires, Lima. The story that captured my imagination is the story of Josephine Harris. You may have heard about it. I may not get it exactly right, but here we go. Josephine was headed down the stairs of the South Tower and was having difficulty. There was a group of firemen who were helping her when they heard what they knew to be the North Tower collapsing. They continued onward, but Josephine could only move so fast and needed to stop from time to time to rest. She knew she was holding them all up and told them to go on without her. They looked at each other and made the decision. They'd stay. They'd all stay together at the speed Josephine had set. They were almost at the bottom when they heard the roar of 110 stories coming down on their heads. But somehow, it all fell around them, leaving about 4 floors of the cement stairway they were inside intact. If they'd gone any faster or any slower, they all would have died. They'd made the decision to stick with the speed that Josephine had set, and that had saved them all. The firemen called Josephine their angel. I often think about Josephine when I feel like I'm not getting somewhere or something as fast as I want, or I'm angry when things seem slow. I try to remember her, deciding to accept the speed that is set, whatever it is, and feel grateful that I'm not in that stairway. Not today, anyway. And to just keep going, one step at a time. Danny and I lived together for 8 years, and he remains one of the most important people in my life.